We are all afraid. Massachusetts Democratic Governor Maura Healey says the fear is real. New York Times columnist Marsha Gessen writes, America's police state has arrived. Dissent is being criminalized. People are being deported without due process. Court rulings are being ignored. Democracy, civil liberties, and free speech are all under attack. What can be done to reverse cowboy authoritarianism in America? Our guest today is Heather Cox Richardson. She's professor of history at Boston College. She previously taught at MIT. Her newsletter, Letters from an American, reaches more than a million readers. She spoke at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver on April 10, 2025. The moderator is UBC Professor Heidi Twarick. And now, Heather Cox Richardson.
I wanted to talk today about what's happening in the United States and to address this question of what it means to be an American in 2025. I'm going to argue today that the crisis in today's United States is the logical outcome of 40 years of a Republican ideology that was based in the idea of cowboy individualism. That idea has directed American politics since 1980, at least, when President Ronald Reagan rode it to the White House. Those people who embrace cowboy individualism believe that a true American is a man who operates on his own, outside the community. He needs nothing from the government. He works hard to support himself. He protects his wife and his children, and he asserts his will by dominating others. That ideology is rooted in the mythological image of the American cowboy who began to drive cattle from the border of Texas and Mexico north across the plains to army posts and railheads in 1866. That image sprang to prominence in the years immediately after the Civil War, and in that peculiar moment, it took on a specific anti-government meaning, a political meaning. The Civil War government in the United States set out to protect black Americans from persecution by their white neighbors in the American South. In 1868, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution guaranteed equal protection of the laws to formerly enslaved people. And then 2 years later, in 1870, Congress created the Department of Justice to prosecute those people who attacked black Americans because of their race. So with the federal government suddenly willing to prosecute racial discrimination, former Confederates turned their racial animosity into an economic argument. Beginning in 1871, they claimed that the government's effort to protect civil rights was tantamount to socialism, because the government officials it required to protect black Americans cost tax dollars. And those tax dollars could only come from hardworking white men in the years after the Civil War. And they were providing that money to provide benefits for undeserving, they said, black people. Southern Democrats after the war contrasted that government socialism, as they called it, with the image of the American cowboy, who, in their view, was a young white man who wanted nothing from the government but to be left alone. The cowboy, in their view, was hardworking, he was good with a gun, and he dominated the women and the racial minorities he encountered in the West. That myth countered the idea that the government should protect all Americans equally. The cowboy image actually faded in the early 20th century progressive era, which is itself an interesting story, but it sprang back to prominence in the 1950s and the 1960s as a propaganda tool to oppose the wildly popular post-World War II government. That government reflected the idea that government had a role to play in regulating business, in providing a basic social safety net, in promoting infrastructure, and in protecting civil rights. And those people who were determined to get rid of government regulation and taxation resurrected the myth of the American cowboy. And they championed this idea of cowboy individualism. They embraced the idea that a government that worked for ordinary Americans was a form of socialism because it redistributed wealth from hardworking white people to black Americans, people of color, and women who demanded equal rights. The Republicans nominated Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater, who was famous for his cowboy persona and his white cowboy hat and his opposition to the post-war government. They nominated him for president. And then, of course, in 1980, Ronald Reagan put aside his British riding clothes, put on a Western cowboy hat, and rode that ideology to the White House. That myth of cowboy individualism became central to the culture of Republican politics as a way for Republican politicians to convince voters to support the destruction of federal government programs that actually benefited them. From 1981 to 2021, Republican policies moved more than $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%. And the party stayed in power through media disinformation, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the flood of money into politics. Those systemic changes to the political system in the United States moved the Republican Party farther and farther and farther right. And the rhetoric of cowboy individualism, as it did so, became more and more extreme. They demonized non-white Americans and women in the public sphere, and they dismissed all government policies that promoted social cooperation, whether at home or abroad. And in place of the post-World War II idea of cooperation among equals, they replaced that idea with the idea that individual men should dominate society, ordering it as they thought best. Over time, white men rejected the socialization and the education that would enable them to rise to prosperity or to develop meaningful relationships. That domination to which they turned at the heart of cowboy individualism grew increasingly apparent in the United States after 1992, when the modern militia movement took off after a standoff at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, between federal marshals and a former factory worker named Randy Weaver, who had failed to show up to court for a trial on a firearms charge, convinced a number of Western men that they had to arm themselves to fight off the government. By the early 2000s in the US, gun ownership first became a symbol of cultural identity, and then it became a way to groom younger people into Republican political ideology. This is why we see political leaders posing with their families holding AR-15s on Christmas cards. The Trump administration has taken cowboy individualism now to an extreme, I believe, gutting the U.S. government and centering power in a dominant president, while also pulling the United States out of the web of international organizations that have stabilized the globe since World War II. The administration began its run in 2025 by firing the women and the racial and gender minorities who held positions in the government. But it is not just exercising domination over others. It is reveling in that dominance and advertising it, especially over the migrants it has sent to prison in El Salvador, showing films of them being transported in chains, and displaying caged prisoners behind Homeland Security Kristi Noem, who in those photographs and in that film is wearing a $50,000 gold Rolex watch. In place of cooperation, the Trump administration's determination to exercise its dominance shows, I think, in its plan to invest $1 trillion in the military, after gutting the U.S. Agency for International Development, also known as USAID. Trump has always seen power as a zero-sum game in which for one party to win, others must lose. If, in fact, Trump succeeds in asserting his dominance over the United States of America and over the globe, the Republicans will have succeeded in replacing American democracy with a dictatorship, and they will have rebalanced global power. But, you know with me, there's always a but, right? Those who believe in that ideology of cowboy individualism have not yet established that autocracy that is their endgame, in large part because that cowboy ideology is a myth. It has never reflected reality. And right now, MAGA Republicans are watching in real time as their president, Donald Trump, lumps them in with the minorities and people of color they believed were inferior to them. The government programs that Republicans are calling wasteful are not just the ones that supported racial minorities. They are the ones that supported MAGA Republicans. Cowboy individualism was always a myth. It never represented the United States of America. It didn't even represent the cowboys, one-third of whom were black or were men of color, and whose employment actually replicated the low pay and dangerous conditions of Eastern factory workers. In fact, the American West was a multicultural world in which the key to surviving and even prospering was not dominating other people, it was kinship ties and communities. Famous Western trader Kit Carson, for example, often lionized as the real hero of cowboy individualism, spoke English, Spanish, a number of indigenous languages, and was married three times, two times to an indigenous woman, and then to a Mexican woman. When Eastern settlers moved west, they depended on communities to enable them to survive disasters because, for example, every single farm would lose a barn to fire at some point, and you needed to have people for barn raising. That focus on communities in the American West gave the United States of America grassroots political movements, which were named, after all, for the prairie grasses, whose roots can go as deep as 3.5 meters. Those movements included the late 19th century Alliance Movement and the populist movements in the late 19th century that reordered American politics. Central to those movements, those grassroots movements, were the Western women who organized to fund churches and to fund schools and who drove Western politics. For example, when the Western state of Iowa added murals to its state house in 1908 to portray the modern government, the duties of defense, charities, education, and the executive, legislative, and the judiciary, it illustrated those aspects of modern American government, all except defense and legislature, it portrayed them as women. The contrast between the myth of cowboy individualism and the reality of life in the American West matters because they represent two very different versions of the American government. Iowa's depiction of the modern government as support for an inclusive society in which women took full part was part of a larger movement in the early 20th century to change the nature of American government itself. Key to that change was social worker Frances Perkins, which is why you've been hearing so much about her from me lately. As a settlement house worker, she saw firsthand what economists will tell you today, that modern industrialization could not survive without the labor and the participation of the entire community, not just male factory workers, who were actually paid lower than survival wages. Later, when she witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, Perkins also saw what happened to communities without government regulation and social services. "I can't begin to tell you how disturbed the people were everywhere," Perkins recalled after the fire. "It was as though we had all done something wrong. It shouldn't have been. We were sorry. We didn't want it that way. We hadn't intended to have 147 girls and boys killed in a factory. It was a terrible thing for the people of the city of New York and the state of New York to face." With her help, the New York Democratic machine remade New York state politics to address the needs of the entire community. When Perkins became Secretary of Labor under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, she took that new government philosophy to the federal level, where she ushered in a dramatic change to the nature of the federal government. With the 1935 Social Security Act, Perkins did more than provide benefits for the elderly and orphans. She created a new kind of United States government. Before Perkins, the primary function of the federal government was to manage the economic relationships between labor, capital, and resources. Property rights, after all, had been the basis on which North American colonists had found the justification, the legal justification, to rebel against the British crown. And the focus on the relationships inherent in property ownership had continued to dominate the government that American lawmakers built afterward. But Perkins recognized that the end of government was not to protect property. It was to protect the communities of people who lived in the nation. She recognized that children, the elderly, women, and disabled Americans were as valuable to that community as the young male workers and the wealthy men who employed them. And she molded the government to reflect the idea that the equal value of all Americans meant that they should all have equal protection of the laws and equal access to resources, including social services like health care, education, and child care. Her vision of the U.S. government reflected reality. But Perkins' recognition of community as the heart of the nation directly challenged the power of men who could dominate a world that had been defined by economic relationships. As soon as the Social Security Act passed, opponents worked to destroy it and the new idea of government that it represented. Reaching back to the past, they claimed that such a government would destroy men's willingness to work and ruin the individualism that made America great. In the 1930s, as soon as the New Deal reorganized government around communities, established businessmen set out to resurrect that old form of government, that old economic ideology. And to bolster their support, they welcomed racists who opposed the idea of equal rights for racial and ethnic minorities to their coalition, and that unholy alliance has been well studied. But they also turned to religious traditionalists who had stood against the teaching of evolution in the Scopes trial just a dozen years before the passage of the Social Security Act. Religious traditionalists, especially those in the Southern Baptist Convention, opposed the new system because it recognized equal rights for women. Women's equality, they believed, meant the end of the patriarchy that they thought mirrored God's relationship to his people, and they saw it as an affront to God. Their position that the modern government was un-American then was strengthened in 1962 when the Supreme Court decided the Engle v. Vitale decision, which struck down state-mandated prayer in public schools, and then in 1963 when Abingdon School District v. Shemp prohibited teachers from leading students in prayer or Bible readings. The Supreme Court decisions against prayer in the schools reinforced the idea that the modern government opposed family values. That religious traditionalism took political shape in 1967 when Southern Baptist leaders Paul Pressler and Paige Patterson plotted to take the Southern Baptists back to an older view of the world. They focused on the inerrancy of the Bible, that is, the Bible can't be wrong, but it was really about women's rights, their ideology. They were denying women's equality and pushing them back into a position subordinate to men. By 1972, the issue of abortion would bring this sexist religious backlash into American politics. Abortion had become a centerpiece of the post-World War II government after doctors identified abortion access as a major public health issue in the 1960s. They estimated that there were between 200,000 and 1.2 million illegal U.S. abortions a year, endangering the lives of women, primarily poor women who could not afford a workaround. By 1972, 64% of Americans believed that abortion should be a question answered by a woman and her doctor. 68% of Republicans believed that. But in 1972, before Roe v. Wade, President Richard Nixon was up for re-election, and he and his people were terrified that he would lose the election. So his advisor, Pat Buchanan, urged Nixon to woo Catholic Democrats before the election by turning to the issue of abortion. Although Nixon had virtually the same platform on the issue as Democratic nominee George McGovern, Nixon and Buchanan defined McGovern as the candidate of acid, amnesty for draft dodgers, and abortion, a radical framing designed to attract traditionalists to the Republican Party. As Nixon split the U.S. in two to rally voters, his supporters used abortion to stand in for women's rights in general. Railing against women's equal rights, in her first statement on abortion in 1972, again the year before Roe versus Wade, activist Phyllis Schlafly did not talk about fetuses, but she talked about women's equality. Women's Lib, short for Women's Liberation, is a total assault on the role of the American woman as wife and mother, and on the family as the basic unit of society. Women's Libbers are trying to make wives and mothers unhappy with their career, make them feel that they are second-class citizens and abject slaves. They are promoting federal daycare centers for babies instead of homes. They are promoting abortions instead of families. In 1979, the first deadline for the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment enshrining women's rights in the U.S. Constitution passed with the amendment unratified, and candidate Ronald Reagan welcomed right-wing Southern Baptist leaders like Pat Robertson, Billy Graham, and Jerry Falwell into his coalition. As the power of those evangelicals grew, Republican culture attacked the modern government by relegating women to the roles of wives and mothers or as sex objects. With talk radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh referring to women who wanted equal rights as feminazis who were destroying society, and after 1996, the Fox News Channel portrayed women's ideal submissive role quite carefully as younger women deferred to older white male hosts like Bill O'Reilly and displayed their bodies under low-cut shirts and short skirts that could be seen under the new glass desks that they used on those sets. But this attempt to undermine the modern government was running up against women's changing political voice. American women tended to vote as their husbands did until 1980, when political observers first saw a gender gap in voting. Women turn out in higher numbers to vote than men do, and at higher rates, and they vote for Democratic candidates at higher rates than men do. If you break that statistic down by race, the numbers are even starker, with Black women and women of color voting in significantly higher percentages for Democratic candidates than men do. So the attempt to get rid of the modern American state began to take shape as an evangelical emphasis on gender domination in households. Wildly popular books and religious culture emphasized a woman's duty to produce a lot of children and to do as her husband or father told her. In 2014 and 2015, this impulse to remove the equality of women from American society showed in Gamergate. When men complained about their inability to find women who would date them and began to call themselves incels or involuntary celibates and began to refer to women as NPCs, non-player characters, who are there to make the story move forward for the playing characters. By the way, a term that you see Elon Musk using a lot these days. When you see NPCs, that's what he's talking about. In the 2016 campaign, Republican candidate Donald Trump faced off against Hillary Clinton, who had so specifically defended the idea of a community-based government that she wrote a book titled It Takes a Village. Trump demonstrated his dominance over Clinton by physically looming over her at a debate. He called for her to be jailed, and then he boasted of sexual assault. But that boast of sexual assault did not end his candidacy, it strengthened it, as a certain group of Republicans saw attacks on women as attacks on the government that they hated. Once in power, Trump gave the evangelicals what they wanted by stacking the Supreme Court with justices who would overturn abortion rights. In 2025, Trump returned to power by warning voters that the modern American state was literally turning boys into girls. While his vice president, J.D. Vance, urged women to embrace traditional gender roles, including staying in abusive marriages for the sake of the children. In contrast, Democratic candidates, Vice President Kamala Harris and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, emphasized community and the role of government in protecting that community.
You're listening to Heather Cox Richardson on Cowboy Authoritarianism in America. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Now, Trump's MAGA Republicans control all the branches of the government. But it is not clear that they will be able to suppress the vast majority of Americans who continue to support the government that Francis Perkins ushered in 90 years ago. For one thing, Republican voters are learning that the government they thought was helping women and minorities actually helps them and kept the nation safe. But there's also a key factor at play right now that is coming to a conclusion after the long-standing Republican attacks on women. As they did in Perkins's era, women are still central to the American community, but now there is a twist. Two generations of women striving for education meant that men backed away from professions once women reached parity in those professions. And now women are dominating educational achievement in the United States, making them more prepared for a modern government than young men are. The past 40 years has also created a new demographic. Women now have educations and connections, they have skills, often they have money, and the people who are now in the boomer generation and slightly below it are the first generation of American women to have 20 to 30 years after their children leave home to invent a second career. Many of them are turning to issues they care about, including political organizing. Indeed, so nervous are MAGA Republican leaders about women's political roles that they're trying to throw women out of political power altogether. The House passed the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or the SAVE Act, which would require all American voters to prove they are citizens by presenting documentation in person when registering to vote or updating their voter registration information. But the kicker is that your official identification has to match your current name. That means that it would disfranchise as many as 69 million American women who do not have passports and whose birth certificates are not in their current married names. That SAVE Act, I think, dovetails with the extraordinary misogyny that has come to dominate the MAGA Republican Party. And I'm going to argue that it is not an accident that the current attempt in the United States to overthrow democracy presents as an attack on American women. American women created and then maintained the American state the Trump administration is currently dismantling. Whether they will save it and realize the government Francis Perkins set out to establish 90 years ago, a government based in the reality that the community is the centerpiece of American society, or whether they won't, is the story of America not just in this moment, but for our future. And I always like to point out that it's worth remembering that the mythological cowboy never stuck around. He actually rode off into the sunset and left the people behind to govern the community. Thank you very much.
One of the things we keep reading in the newspapers today is how unprecedented everything that the Trump administration has been doing over the last few months is. And I wonder if you as the historian can take a bit of a step back for us and separate out a little bit the things that you really think are unprecedented about what we've been seeing in the last few months.
It's dizzying, isn't it? So I am one of the people who called it a constitutional crisis from very early days. And the reason for that, and the reason I was impatient with those who did not, is because our Constitution is really very clear. And the clarity of where the government power comes from is also quite clear. And it comes from we the people, which might be worth picking up. But in our Constitution, there's three main articles. So when someone talks about Article 2 powers, that's what they're talking about, is what's in that. Article 1 sets up the lawmaking bodies of the United States government, and that is the House of Representatives and Congress and the Senate that are the legislative body. That is the only body in the federal government that can write a law, that can make a law. And the Article 2 powers are the powers of the president. And the president's duty is to execute the laws, make sure that they are carried out in good faith. So the minute that the Trump administration got into power and withheld the appropriations that had been made by Congress for the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is a congressionally established agency, he was taking the power of Congress, one of our three branches of government, and relegating it to himself. That is a constitutional crisis that is explicitly against the law, and according to the 1974 Impoundment Control Act, which said to Richard Nixon, you can't do this. This is what Trump was impeached for in 2019 when he withheld money that had been appropriated for the Ukraine's military. And that, right out of the box, was the first thing that was unprecedented. But since then, of course, we have the problem of the fact that the Trump administration is operating outside the Constitution. They're not just breaking the laws, they're acting extra constitutionally, which makes things really difficult because we have systems set up for when people break the laws. We don't have systems set up for when people say, I'm going to pull this billionaire off the street, give him access to all Americans' data, and you know, good luck with that. So in doing so, in working outside the Constitution, they have created many different places in which they have broken laws, which is going to make it very hard for them to back down. And then the other thing is the quite deliberate destruction of the different pieces of our Bill of Rights that protect liberties. And those are ramping up on a daily basis with the idea, I think, of overawing people so they don't fight back. But so far, it's had the opposite effect. A lot of people who otherwise wouldn't be paying very close attention notice when a graduate student gets kidnapped off the streets and sent to prison in Louisiana.
Yeah, and I think your description of a constitutional crisis is one way of trying to express there's something really unprecedented about this. There's something urgent. It is some kind of emergency. One of the other ways that prominent historians have been trying to do that, like Ruth Ben-Ghiat or Tim Snyder, is through comparisons with fascism. And I wonder if you could just reflect a little bit about whether you think is that useful or not, or do you want to keep rooting it as you do really in American history?
There's two ways to answer that, and one of the ways in which we're in quite unusual territory for the United States is we have in power a group of people who are actively trying to destroy democracy. Now, we've had that in the States before. If you think about the American South from about 1874 to about 1965, those were one-party states in which not everybody enjoyed equality before the law. In fact, very few people enjoyed equality before the law. But this is the first time we actually have people in America doing it. So I'm one of those annoying people who doesn't like the word fascism because fascism has a number of economic policies that the Trump administration is really not embracing in favor of authoritarianism. And in that, we're in a new moment, I think, and this is not new to me saying this. There's a number of people who study, for example, international crime, who noticed within about 15 years ago that the criminals around the world are working together with political leaders and sometimes lawmakers to create a new kind of power structure, a criminal power structure around the entire globe. And so if you think about what the Trump administration is trying to do, to me, it looks much
more like somebody like Viktor Orban in Hungary, who of course has a much smaller country than the United States is, but Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, for example, literally took a number of the laws that they've put in place in Florida from laws that Viktor Orban put in place in Hungary. And the right-wing conservative political action committee, not committee, conference, has, of course, spoken, had Viktor Orban come speak, and they have had their Tucker Carlson go and interview Orban a number of times. So when I think about what I see in the United States right now, when I look at what the Trump administration is doing, I think the models are much more the kind of model you see in other countries than even in some place like the American South. So that's the direction that I would look. And while fascism is a very useful term for the destruction of rights and liberties, I study the economy, so I'm kind of like, that's not quite what he's doing, because if you look at the tariffs, for example, the sheer caprice of them is something that you'd have a much harder time getting through a fascist system than you would through an authoritarian system. So you can call it fascist if you want, but I'm much more into authoritarianism.
I think there are uses that many of these authors have for calling it fascism, which I think to try and draw attention to this as a crisis, right? And that's part of it. But there are also a huge number of distinctions. The way that I've thought about it is what Robert Paxton talks about, where one of the most famous people talking about fascism, his view has been, we could call this fascist, but it's also not helpful politically. It doesn't really get us anywhere. And I think that's actually quite helpful. So the way that I've been thinking about it, to move to my next question, is to draw on what Daniel Ziblatt, political scientist, has been talking about when he's been describing what Trump is aiming at as something more akin to competitive authoritarianism. There'll still be elections, but it's going to be harder and harder for the Democrats to win. So I'd love to hear a little bit more of your reflections on that, whether it's comparisons with Hungary or Turkey. Do you see competitive authoritarianism as a better description of where the U.S. might be heading?
I do, and I love his work. And yes, the concept of competitive authoritarianism is that, yes, there will always be elections, but you already know who's going to win one of them. And that's the same kind of things you saw in Russia or in Hungary are exactly the same things you're seeing here, an attempt really to crack down on the media, to delegitimize opponents, political opponents. But to maybe add a little bit to something that he said, I have been fascinated for years now by the concept that is associated with Russian political theorists, but I have never been convinced that it came entirely from Russian political theorists. And that is the concept of virtual technology or virtual politics. And that's the idea of creating a false reality around which voters come to cast their votes. So they believe they're voting for something they are not, which, if you're following American politics right now, you don't have to go real far to look at people going, he's doing what with the tariffs? That's not what I voted for. But that idea of using a fake reality to convince people to vote away their own democracy, one of the reasons I don't think it is associated, I don't associate it only with Russia, is because that's really been something that the Republican Party has been doing now since at least 1978. And so the cross-pollinization of political operatives between America and what, at the time was called the torturers' lobby in the 1980s, and then in the 1990s after the fall of the Soviet Union, strikes me as having a lot of commonalities between the United States and countries like Russia or countries like Belarus or Ukraine, who have faced a similar situation of political operatives convincing people of a fake reality, of a virtual politics. And in this moment, one of the things, if you read these books, it's really interesting, is they talk about how you destabilize a democratic population and how you can get them to vote away their democracy and how they become yours and how you start to scoop everything up. But they never talk about what happens when a people realizes that's happened to them. That, to me, is the interesting moment. Because in the United States, what I think we're seeing is the rise of a reality-based media that rejects the same kinds of fake stories that you see even to some degree in the legacy media, but certainly in right-wing media. And you also see the reassertion of reality. But I also suspect that when people who have sold their political and perhaps personal identities to that fake image, discover that they were sold a bill of goods, they're going to be angry. And that, I think, is what we're going to see in the United States. If you know, one of the reasons I read Reddit a lot is people vent on Reddit, but they vent intelligently on Reddit, unlike on Twitter. And they vent about why they're mad. And a lot of people are really mad right now who were full-fledged MAGAs before.
So I want to dig into this question of virtual reality. I would love to hear from you your perspective of how Republicans have built this. What are the channels that they've used? So expanding a little bit more on, there's the Fox News, but the talk radio. Tell us a little bit more about your 40-year potted history of how Republicans have created this virtual reality.
You see the rise, really, with Reagan, although the roots of it are in Richard Nixon's 1968 campaign, of creating this image. And this, the Nixon campaign does it very deliberately, and the guy who runs it in the Nixon campaign is Roger Ailes, who's going to come back in just a minute. So you get Nixon, and then you get the frustration of the people who are trying to get rid of the U.S. government, the activist U.S. government, with the fact that every time they keep warning people that they shouldn't like this government, they're like, what are you talking about? We have union protections, we have jobs, we have roads, you know, we like this government. And they got frustrated because they felt that no matter what they said, people voted for the other side. And so they began to really push the idea that their point of view had to be represented in the American media. But the problem was that we had this something called the Fairness Doctrine that said that if you were making an argument in the media, it had to be supported by facts, and you had to represent the other side as well. So in order to make sure that their point of view, which was based in Christianity and based in getting rid of regulations and a social safety net and taxes, in order to make sure that that was available, they really pressured Reagan to put on our Federal Communications Commission a group of people who believed in what we called movement conservatism. They called themselves conservatives, but they were not conservative. They were radical, but they were a political movement. So that's what movement conservatism is. So in 1987, we lose the Fairness Doctrine. And we lose the Fairness Doctrine just as FM radio is coming on really effectively, so that AM radio stations need ears. And they start to run shock jocks, and the shock jocks figure out that politics sells. So Rush Limbaugh does not start as a political shock jock. He becomes a political shock jock. So by 1988, you have Rush Limbaugh with a national show. And then, of course, you get the Fox News Channel in 1996, which brings that image to television. And, of course, that's run by Roger Ailes. You know, this is a theme. But to that concept of creating this right-wing media and the ecosystem around it has grown since then, and you know the rest. You know the fall of local media because of the concentration of newspapers, for example, and the overcapitalization of media and so on. But let me just jump forward to this moment, because I think this moment is so interesting. We know now that one of the reasons that President Donald Trump was able to essentially not do any media, not do any interviews or so on in the 2024 election was because they had created an entirely alternative media. And that media was not just the things that people like me were watching, like Newsmax or OAN or the Fox News Channel, or the things that you have heard of. They were paying influencers on politics adjacent things like nutrition podcasts, yoga podcasts, the Tradwife, Instagram things, all that stuff. So they were permeating a group of people that the rest of us weren't even paying attention to. I think we're in a whole new world. And one of the things that you are seeing, if you're watching this stuff closely now, is that people in the reality-based community have figured this out. And so if you're watching social media closely now, you will see the real cross-pollinization of people working in the reality-based media and the real attempt to throw up new, younger, politics-adjacent voices.
What lessons from history offer us hope about reversing the immense influence of ultra-wealth on controlling a democracy?
I'm glad you specified wealth, because there are a number of studies of how one reclaims a democracy from an autocracy. But the thing about the extraordinary wealth in the United States right now is that we have a very clear pattern for overcoming that, because this is exactly what the United States looked like during what we knew as the Gilded Age, or the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And what was key to that was not only the obvious things like the rise of a new media, which of course we're seeing now. We had the exact same thing happen in the late 19th century with the rise of magazines like McClure's Magazine, which you may have heard of and which is available online, by the way, that said to people who were not otherwise paying attention and were simply reading the legacy media, you know, hey, do you know what J.D. Rockefeller's doing with oil and how he's destroying small businesses? Or, hey, do you know how the cities of Minneapolis, Ray Stanner Baker wrote about Minneapolis and how Minneapolis was corrupt and so on? And that engaged a lot of people in the political process that weren't otherwise engaged. And you saw the rise of things like the Alliance Movement and the Populist Movement from this new media, much of which was ephemeral, and we don't have it anymore, which breaks my heart. You know, South Dakota had a huge range of Alliance newspapers. That's where the Alliance began, and they're all gone. So there is the rise of new media, and there is the rise of increasing language against those politicians. Because everybody writes to me and says, well, why should I complain to my Republican politicians? They're not going to change anything. I'm like, no, of course they're not. Ron Johnson is not suddenly going to start voting for the Democrats. But lots of people would like to get elected to replace Ron Johnson, and they will listen to what you are saying. And you're already seeing this around the United States right now. All kinds of people throwing their hats into the ring, new faces and new ideas for the midterm elections and then eventually for the next presidential election. But that's not the only place that you see the rise of a pushback against the extraordinary wealth that has garnered power in the United States in this era, but also in the last. The humanities are really important. Music and art are really important because they give voices to people who are otherwise excluded from that political system. And if you think about the late 19th century and the parallels to the present, we had new kinds of clothing. We had new voices. We had new foods. We had new languages. We had new art. And I always point to the Armory exhibit of 1913 in New York City, the New York City Armory exhibit, which is always heralded as the rise of modern art and how dramatically that changed the way people saw the world. But it's not like they started painting in 1912 for the 1913 Armory. That came out of the late 19th century. The new music, jazz and ragtime and cowboy poetry and all the new forms of artistic expression created new ways to talk about communities and about pushing back against those very wealthy people who were using the government for themselves. At the same time in that era, you got huge numbers of social groups like the Odd Fellows and the Masons and the fraternal and sororal organizations. And they began to provide the kinds of support for individuals that the government was not doing. But they made it clear they would like those things. So, for example, the Knights of Columbus at one point, you know, were providing insurance and death benefits for their members. So you start to see all these new organizations and these new ideas, new languages, as I say, and music and so on. And you see the reality that the current government is not answering the needs of any except a very few. I would argue the exact same thing is happening in the United States today. All of the things I just said you've seen parallels to, including the rise of new organizations, but you're not seeing them in the streets so much as you're seeing them on social media, where, you know, people have millions of individuals who come together to support a cause or a person or whatever. And for me, one of the most dramatic news in the United States in the last at least 5 years was the popular reaction to the shooting of the United Healthcare CEO in Manhattan. TikTok was a light for weeks. There are images that circulate around the United States of the shooter as a saint. You know, people are paying his legal bills. That lionization of a man who took on the healthcare system, but really the wealth that is dominating American society, indicated to me a powder keg.
Yeah. As we're on a university campus, I want to ask you the question about the Trump administration's cuts to university funding, canceling grants for the National Endowment for Humanities, National Science Foundation, you name it.
You have to start by remembering that there's three factions of MAGA that are currently operating out of the White House. And Donald Trump is a figurehead for those. He is not in control of this administration. I believe that. Not that they're tying him up in the basement, but he has admitted in many ways that he is not the one calling the shots. So he has said, for example, that he was not the person who signed the order that put the 1798 Alien Enemies Act into use for rending migrants to El Salvador. Now, maybe he signed it, maybe he didn't. But in any case, that was a really big deal for the president to say, I don't know what you're talking about. And the number of times he said, I don't know, I didn't have anything to do with that. You got to talk to somebody who did, when he's the president, suggests that there's a problem there. But those three factions are struggling over controlling the administration. And that would be the broligarchs, who are, you can think of them as Elon Musk. I'm giving you the shorthand. There's the Project 2025 people, who is Russell Vogt, who's the director of the Office of Management and Budget, that is really putting that stuff in place very quietly. He's really running under the radar, but he's the one who's really getting stuff accomplished. And then there is the sort of Hungarian faction, which is being run out of the Deputy White House Chief of Staff position, and that's Stephen Miller. And he's working with Kristi Noem, who is the Secretary of Homeland Security. They're the ones who want to get rid of everybody with brown or black skin. And they're the ones who are behind the migrant stuff. So you got those three people going on. But it's really important to remember to take this. Here's my onion. I'm taking you in the onion. It's really important to remember that of those three groups, Stephen Miller wants a very powerful government right away. But the Project 2025 people and the broligarchs want to take American government down to the dirt. They want to get rid of the government. They want to get rid of the health care. They want to get rid of science. They want to get rid of Social Security. They want to get rid of Medicare. They want to get rid of Medicaid. They want to get rid of everything. And they want to get rid of education, because they believe that all of those things have been tainted by the government I was talking about, what they call a liberal government or a secular government. And that it's not just a question of replacing people and putting somebody else in power that votes Republican. They want to get rid of those things altogether. And that's what you're watching happen right now. So when they're going after education, they're not just mad at Columbia or at Harvard or at whatever. They are literally trying to destroy the current educational system the way it exists. Now, what's interesting to me, and I mentioned Russell Vogt there, is they're not talking a lot about what they want to put in its place, are they? Now, Stephen Miller wants to control a strong government, and both of those groups also want to control a strong government. Elon Musk wants to have government contracts so he can get to Mars. And then the Project 2025 people want a strong government so they can impose religious rule. Stephen Miller wants a strong government so he can have a white supremacist, you know, white, you know, every white people get everything government. But they don't agree with each other, and they're disagreeing about how to implement that. So one of the things to be watching from up here is the stresses within that White House, not just the actions, but what they're trying to do going forward and where there are divisions among them.
Heather, you wanted a small final question, so I'll give it to you. This series is called What It Means to Be an American. Tell us in three words, what do you think it means to be an American?
Oh, that's so easy. We have hope.
You were just listening to Heather Cox Richardson on Cowboy Authoritarianism in America. She spoke at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver on April 10th, 2025, as part of its What It Means to Be an American series. Heather Cox Richardson is professor of history at Boston College. Her newsletter, Letters from an American, reaches more than a million readers. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Naomi Klein, Gabor Mate, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program and for Howard Zinn's classic book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to UBC's School of Public Policy and Global Affairs and the Chan Center for the Performing Arts. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Four years ago, Texas experienced its worst blackout in state history. But there's one factor that never got much attention.
Natural gas failed in a big way.
The gas system that feeds many power plants simply didn't work. But why?
There's no plausible explanation for it other than a manipulation of price and a manipulation of supply.
Season 3 of The Disconnect, Power, Politics, and the Texas Blackout is out now. Find it at KUT.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
My family had the most effect on my becoming a journalist. I came from a family of serious-minded scholars. I have five brothers and sisters, all of whom are holders of advanced degrees in one field or another. One of my brothers is a holder of two earned PhD degrees. So as you can see, ours is a family heavily oriented toward education and service. I grew up wanting most of all to write and spent most of my childhood experimenting with writing and concluded that it was the world for me. I saw so much that I thought needed to be described, communicated, explored, explained, and so forth. So that just became my outlet.
The late Robert C. Maynard, journalist, newspaper publisher, editor, and former owner of the Oakland Tribune newspaper. Maynard was a charismatic leader who changed the face of American journalism and built a four-decade career on the cornerstone of editorial integrity, community involvement, improved education, and the importance of the family. He was also co-founder of the Institute for Journalism Education, a nonprofit corporation dedicated to expanding opportunities for minority journalists at the nation's newspapers. In the 1980s, Maynard began a twice-weekly syndicated newspaper column in which he transformed national and international issues into dinner table discussions of right and wrong. When he bought the Oakland Tribune in 1983, he became the first African-American in this country to own a major daily newspaper. But Maynard had a career full of firsts, from being the first African-American national newspaper correspondent to being the first African-American newspaper editor-in-chief. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Life and Legacy of Robert C. Maynard in Black America.
Before I go on to say how that particular movement affected me personally, I want to say something about our profession that I think is an indictment of sorts. You know, we still have a ways to go toward full equality for blacks in America. But I think it's unfortunate that our media has not made it clear to the American people that what happened between 1950 and 1980, let's say, in America, 30 years, is probably one of the most phenomenal revolutions that's occurred in human history. To take the condition that blacks were in those days and to see the number of barriers that fell and the number of conditions that changed and the number of opportunities that present themselves today versus in that day. And it's a remarkable march, and Black Americans should take greater pride in what we have already accomplished. That does not mean we should slacken in what we feel we need to continue to accomplish, but we should not allow ourselves, or deny ourselves, I should say, we shouldn't deny ourselves a justly deserved compliment.
The late Robert C. Maynard was a dynamic leader in American journalism throughout the 1970s and 1980s. He was the first African American to own a major metropolitan daily newspaper. Maynard was the publisher of a struggling Oakland Tribune from 1983 until 1992. Through that newspaper and the Institute for Journalism Education, which he co-founded in 1976, he became instrumental in training and placing minority journalists in important positions nationwide. Born on June 17, 1937 in Brooklyn, New York, Maynard was the son of immigrants from Barbados. Interested in writing at an early age, he frequently cut class at Boys High School to hang out at the editorial office of a Black weekly newspaper, the New York Age. In 1967, Maynard was hired by the Washington Post as national correspondent, the first African-American to hold that position on any major newspaper. In 1977, he left the Washington Post and moved to the University of California, Berkeley, to found the Institute for Journalism Education. In 1979, he was hired by Gannett as editor in the newly acquired Oakland Tribune newspaper. When he purchased the Oakland Tribune in 1983, he became the first African-American in this country to own a major daily newspaper. In 1985, Maynard was the recipient of the Whit Carter Reddick Award from the College of Communication at the University of Texas at Austin.
Langston had just put on a play called Simple Sings the Blues. And Jimmy Baldwin was just about to publish Notes of a Native Son. This was a period in Afro-American history that I was privileged to be the witness to, which was the moral preparation for the civil rights movement. That's what was going on in the middle to